Hi, my name is Joe Jackson. I'm an interviewer and a broadcaster. And what you're about to hear is one of the 1,400 interviews I did for publications such as the Irish Times, Sunday Independent, Hot Press Magazine, and for RTE Radio 1. How do I know that there are 1,400 interviews exactly? Because I recently digitized all the damn tapes myself. But please remember that many of the interviews were done for the print media and recorded on cassette tapes. So some are, let's say, sonically challenged. But sometimes sonic considerations should give way to historical significance, I believe. And I'm glad to say that at least some powers that be in RTE Radio 1 agreed with me on this, and broadcast between 2015 and 2018 many of my interviews in a series called The Joe Jackson Tapes Revisited. What follows is one such programme edited for this podcast and minus music, which I can't use for copyright reasons. The full tapes can be accessed at joejacksoninterviewer.com. Either way, enjoy. I hate everyone, starting with me. Who said that? I did just now. Listen up, folks, I'm being totally honest here. Now, I'm only joking. I hate everyone, starting with me, actually is the title of a book Joan Rivers had published 2 years before her death in 2014. Sadly, back in 2004, I didn't have those rhapsodic reflections to give me my cue for a few questions for Joan about her childhood. But my guess was that something bad must have happened to her as a child, or else she wouldn't have become a celebrity, right? I'm kidding. Either way, Joan Rivers was mining her own life for material and turning base metal into comedy gold. During our interview, I did discover that Rivers, who was born Joan Alexandra Malinsky in Brooklyn, New York in 1933, actually thought of herself as fat, ugly, and felt socially ostracized as a child. The interview, which was for the Sunday Independent, took place in Joan's hotel room in London in advance of her upcoming gig in Dublin. By the way, I tended to kick off Sindo interviews with what I perceived to be an epiphany someone had, or a major turning point in their life, sometimes out of a dark experience. I did so, hoping to pass on to readers a message of hope or illumination. But before the interview proper began, I said something to Joan about the Irish sense of humour and about the wife of someone I'd interviewed who said something kind about her.
Okay, listen, the Irish are going to love your humour anyway, right? Because the national language of Ireland is the put down. And they say it's because we've been put down for 800 years. And there's a racial truth in that. But the British have been putting us down and telling us we're thick Gombians.
Right, right.
So now, before anyone can say anything, we say it.
Right, that's the whole...
Which I think is part of what your humour is.
Exactly right. It's exactly what all humour is, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Get you before you get me.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I usually do in the article is I talk about... I'm not going to take you through your whole life, but I want some kind of chronology to it. And I'm going to focus on what I perceive to be a few big turning points in your life.
Whatever's good for
you. Great stuff, okay. I also met somebody last week. I don't know if you know him, Frank Delaney, an Irish author. He wrote The Celts, a PBS
documentary. Yes.
And his wife, Diane, now this could be he just name-dropping, apparently knows friends of yours. And she said you're actually an incredibly friendly person and that there's no one better to their friends.
Who is my friend in Shell?
She did. Someone in New York. She's the head of a marketing agency.
That's very sweet. That's lovely.
It's a nice thing for her to say.
Damn
she
right.
said the Joan behind the image is not the Joan.
Isn't that nice?
That's a lovely thing to say.
Yes.
You know? So I'm believing her until you prove the opposite. Isn't she just? Okay. So I saw that a kind of turning point or epiphany for you was that time at 12. When you were telling stories and you realized they were not laughing at you, but why would they be laughing at you anyway?
Well, I was probably the ugliest child in the school. A little fat, homely, not particularly outgoing child. You know, so I was not the butt of all the jokes.
Okay.
But every child is the butt.
But was this at home where you were telling that story to your daddy's friends?
No, so my dad's friends on a fishing trip.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And my father took me, I was probably younger than 12, I was probably about eight, nine. And I realized all these doctors were enjoying the story. They were really laughing and having a very good evening.
And can you remember what you were telling them? What were you spinning?
No, something about my teacher, Miss Beffler.
Okay.
And I just remember that it was such a rush because I thought, I am the focal point of this. And I'm controlling this whole thing. This is very nice.
All right. Did you have a good punchline for that story?
I must have.
It's essential.
I must have.
But you did actually say, and I've seen you say, that comedy is a medium for revenge. That's why I raised that point at the earlier.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Of course.
Okay.
Of course. Anyone does dirt to anyone in my family, to a friend, or to a cause or something, or to me.
All right.
You are so open. I never start first.
Okay.
Like, don't cross it.
Okay. Well, when did, it wasn't at 9 or 12, you
identified
that.
No, it was always, no. The humor was always a buffer, as it is with everybody. Humor was always the thing that you use to make something okay.
All right. Was it a family? Wait, you come from Russian background, Russian immigrant.
Yes.
Parents. Are they like Irish in that sense? Would they have that tendency as retaliatory humor?
It's Jewish.
Jewish. Oh,
and my
Jewish
father,
humor, okay.
My father, obviously, yeah.
Right. And is that part of the Jewish kind of...
Oh, absolutely. Look at all the comedians.
Absolutely.
Two-thirds of them.
Absolutely.
Not all of them, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But two-thirds certainly are Jewish.
Yeah.
And all that Jewish tradition, like Shalom Aleichem stuff and all that, you know, it's... all humor.
So it's very like the Irish thing I was talking about. Getting back before they get at you.
Getting back before they get at you and making the joke before they can make the joke about you.
Oh, and was that how your mom and dad would talk to you? Would they have started that thing of making you feel bad without knowing it?
Oh, no. The opposite. My mother told my sister and I that we were the most beautiful things in the world. We got some shock when you suddenly come out for the first time in your prom dress, and everyone goes, no, my mother ruined us by doing the opposite, by seeing nothing wrong with us.
Okay.
Never
right,
correcting
right.
us. We were perfect.
So it didn't prepare you for the world?
Not
and
as.
Truth, because too much love can be as damaging as
yes,
too little love.
We were the stars of the universe.
Okay.
And then you're going to realize and say, you're not pretty, you're not this, you're not that, you're just a fat little pig. My mother said.
But now you have to stay the star of the universe. That's the pattern she set in place.
That's what I've been striving for.
good damn you, ma'am. That already set me up on this track. But you mentioned there, and I know that when you heard Lenny Bruce,
about
the element of that realizing outrageousness, that it can be cleansing, that social element can be really.
It's not outrageousness for outrageousness.
Okay.
It's out to make a point, and sometimes you have to shake people.
All right.
To say, listen to me. I say that a lot now. I used to say, can we talk, which is the same thing. I never even realized I said it.
Okay.
But when they would say, I go, can we talk for a second? Don't give me that every woman does not care whether she's pretty or not. So now I say, will you listen to me for a second?
Okay.
And now I'll say to them, tell me I'm wrong.
Okay.
And they get very quiet.
Okay.
Tell me I'm wrong. I yell at them.
All right.
But I want them to wake up. And I think if you can face something that is really upsetting you and you realize, A, everybody's upset by it, and B, it's really funny, and it's also stupid in the end.
All right. Yeah.
And that's what my act ends up being.
Were you at a Lenny Bruce concert when you were, or a gig, when you got that little crystal light coming on?
When I saw him, I realized he's talking about what I'm talking about. But also that
I... Can you remember what he was talking... What was this
discussion? I didn't even know what he was saying
right, okay.
that time.
It just rang a bell.
It was just... He went right for the bare bone of whatever the situation
was. Like the way he played with language, the way he called people a kike and a nigger and waited
so
for them to punch him out.
But when he went through the whole audience, he said, you're a kike, you're a nigger, you're a mick, you're a pro-op, you're a...
Yeah.
So...
But it came close. You could see some...
And some people would get angry. And he'd say, what were you saying? He goes, we're all something, so what does it matter? So everyone, relax.
Yeah.
And I do that. I say something at the start of my act, I'd say something really outrageous. And then I'll say to the audience, just relax, because you think that was bad, wait.
Okay.
Yes, I know that in these days of sometimes suffocating political correctness, some people will insist I should now apologize for using heinous words such as mix, related to we Irish, kikes, related to Jews, and niggers as applied to blacks. But let's not forget, I was paraphrasing one of Lenny Bruce's most incendiary monologues. Besides, as a Mick or a Paddy myself, who like us all has been subjected to racial stereotyping, I find the tendency as offensive as anyone does. Apart from maybe President Trump. Oops. Moving quickly on, in this next section, the Carson Joan refers to is not Kit Carson the cowboy, it's talk show host Johnny Carson.
When you left college, I believe you said somewhere, no wonder Iago killed me, about a kind of production you appeared in.
Yeah, New York accent, you're playing a million. Didn't go down too well. But I figured, hey.
But was that in college? You obviously hadn't identified comedy as your forte. You identified acting, had you?
I still do.
Oh, right, okay.
Still, I think of myself as an actor.
All right, okay.
I just did Nip Tuck. Do you get that?
Yeah,
out?
We do, yeah.
I did the final episode.
Oh, right, okay.
And everyone thinks I'm doing it as myself, you know. It's a straight acting job.
All right, okay.
And
all
I
right.
loved it because I sat with the actors and we talked acting. We talked techniques
all
in between
right, all
roles.
Right, okay.
So I still think of myself as an actress.
So that's what you were studying or that's what you were aiming for in college?
Actress.
And did your folks approve of that? Did they
no.
want that? No, they wouldn't. Why?
My parents were first generation immigrants.
Yeah.
And that's all about bettering yourself and getting your children that good education. And your next generation will be even smarter and
all right.
brighter.
All right, yeah.
And that's what my sister was the youngest graduate of Columbia Law School.
Okay.
Woman.
Okay. And were you meant to follow that then?
Absolutely.
All right, okay.
Absolutely. And if I had come to them and said, and this is 1958, if I had come and said, I want to go on and become the world's best surgeon, it will take 22 years of training, Dad. My father would have said, wonderful.
Okay.
And I came and said, I want to be an actress. No. These are not where we set our sights.
But did they threaten to disown your
acting? They did.
Okay.
It was over a year where no one spoke, where
really?
I lived in my car till I got a job.
You had to cut out of the...
Left home.
Was that an ultimate? Did they say, Joan?
They threw me out. Not through. I left. I don't know who threw. But it was a terrible scene.
All right.
And I stormed out in September and did not come back to the following September.
But did neither of your parents, and I've had the situation with my own dad, they then realized, I'm glad I raised a child that strong.
You had that
with your father. You know?
That's nonsense.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, I can understand a parent saying, well, you want to be a writer. You'll get a job and you'll be a writer
later,
at night.
Later.
Yeah. But is your dad alive?
No, he died.
But did he live to see you?
No.
Successful?
No.
No. That's a killer.
Well, he died in a situation not unlike your own. He was ridiculous.
My.
But we'll get to that. That's heavy to winter. So we never reconciled, which is a
big We never reconciled suicide.
No, you don't. You never reconciled loss either. But did you reconcile with your folks?
Yes, and they lived to see me. That's why I asked you. Lived to see me successful. You know who else's parent didn't see him successful? Elvis Presley's mother. You would ask him, he would cry.
That's true. Yeah.
So here I go. Yeah. I asked you about your dad.
You know who else did? Richard Harris. I interviewed Richard just before he died, and he wept for his father.
He said,
my father never saw me even do a mutiny on the Bounty.
It's terrible.
The ache stays.
Yeah. Oh, gee, the day you die.
Yeah. But after you then, even in the first year where you finally, did you make up with them then, tentatively?
Yes. Right. Because by the time I came back, we had a truce and they said, all right, we'll give you 6 months. And
to establish yourself.
To at least get a job.
Okay.
Which it didn't work, but it became slowly, they finally came around and then they lived to see me successful. And then not only success, but really taking over the Carson show. They both lived long enough to really see. And my mother used to say, all I worry about, are you married?
No.
Do you have children?
No.
Oh, because all you worry about is, we should be all right. We should be able to take care of ourselves. That becomes your next.
Yeah.
That's your next thing. And my mother finally turned to me right slowly before she died. And she said to me, I don't worry about you.
Oh, great.
I don't worry about you anymore.
Okay.
And so that was very gratifying.
But did you also married straight out of college very early?
Yeah.
And you said, I said I'd do, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Was
yeah.
that to play Kate then? Because that was into money, wasn't it?
Yes.
And status.
And status and what you did. And what all my friends.
He was the vice president.
They owned a huge chain of stores.
Right.
Which since went under, but he took over.
She says smiling. He caused you identified that immediately, didn't you? But were you a romantic at that stage? Or did you, Irish set marriage?
It was romantic enough.
Okay.
But it was also, that's what you did. You graduated and every friend got married.
Okay.
All the girls got married. That was what you did.
And that you put, where was this? Did you put your dreams on hold then? Did you say, I'll give up then?
I didn't go to the theater.
All right.
The whole time I was married, I would not go to the theater.
All right.
I just cut it out of my life.
Was that before you, that was obviously after you told the folks you were going to the theater?
No. I did that all right. Then I went home to live at the end of the marriage, which was 6 months.
Yeah.
And that's where I said to them, I've done what you're supposed to do. It doesn't work.
Oh, I see. Right, okay.
So now I want to do what I want to do. And that's when they said, are you out of your mind?
All right. But did the breakup of the marriage wound you romantically?
Oh, no. It was like going to the electric chair and the warden calls you at the last minute and says, she can live. Ah! Those gates are, oh no. I didn't know why I was married. I stood at my wedding in my white dress, and I said to my cousin, who I was very close to, can you believe this?
All right, okay.
Can you believe this?
And, but so it was kind of ill-fated from the start.
Yeah, oh yeah, I feel sorry for the young man looking back, because he went into it really thinking, he had no idea he was married. This miserable girl.
But then when you it was not easy after that. I know you mentioned the Carson,
but there was
lots of years between that, wasn't
seven
there?
Years.
Yeah.
Seven
of playing years. Sleazy dives and with the likes of, was that with Alan and Pryor and all those people?
Yeah, but we were all, and I look back, Bob Dylan, we were all down there together.
In Greenwich Village.
Colin, yeah.
But that must have been a cool, great time.
It was.
Time.
Barbara Streisand, which you didn't know, it was a cool, great time. You were all,
okay.
I mean, we all stayed friends.
You had a lesbian relationship with her, I believe.
Yes.
In a play.
Yes.
Don't forget to add that little line in, Joe.
In a play.
Are you dead meat when
and
I come to Ireland?
And we still see each other.
Good. I'm happy.
And Barbara, I must say, is as tight with a penny as she was. If you want to hear Abe Lincoln cry,
But was it a good time? Did you feel a camaraderie, or was it really painful trying to get someone to actually accept you?
It was a camaraderie because you were accepted within that group.
Right.
And nobody was looking down at you within that group.
All right, okay, yeah.
So it was wonderful.
Right.
You could go into a coffee shop and sit and talk to Woody, because Woody wasn't working either.
Yeah.
And so everybody, yes, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful moment.
Did you have that, what you have described as a bottomless pit of craving for acceptance? Was that
still
also burning at you then?
Always.
Through those years?
Always.
Like eating at you, this is 6 years, 7 years, I'm not getting there.
But there was nothing else to do.
All right.
There was no place else. There was nothing else to do. I mean, that was, I always say, and I don't mean this with disrespect, it was like a religious calling.
Okay.
And when people say to me now, I want to go into the theater. And I said, if you can do, well, say this right, if you can do anything else, are you out of your mind? Don't do it.
Yeah.
Because you're looking for unhappiness. You're looking for heartbreak. You're looking for disappointment. You're looking for rejection. So unless you say, I can't live without it, you're crazy to do it.
But I've interviewed loads of artists in every field, and they're usually driven to assert themselves in art because they did not have love from their parents.
But I did.
But you had it.
I did.
And you still had the craving.
So there was obviously something else, which I don't understand. I don't know what.
Was it because you thought you were fat and ugly as a kid?
Well,
and
that certainly adds to it.
Yeah.
There was always tremendous money problems in the house.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because we lived higher than.
You're the allowance. You
yeah,
couldn't
which
afford.
But that's no big deal. Everybody does that.
Yeah.
There was. It just was there. From the time I could put my eyes to connect with my brain. That's
it was
what
there.
I wanted to do. It was
okay.
There.
And the moment of crystallized was when Carson said you're funny or something like that.
That was when I became a star, in quotes.
So when before that did you feel all the struggling as...
But you know, again, as a writer, you write something, you know it's good, you know. And all the way those 7 years along the way, there'd be an audience that loved you and you'd connect and you could live on that.
Okay.
And then I would work in the village and be 10 bad nights and one great night. And then... one time Lenny Bruce came to see me and he sent a little note back saying, you're right and they're wrong. And you live on that.
That's great.
You know, you save that note, you live on that note for 2 years. And so all the way along, there were little things happening that kept me functioning.
But you didn't follow the Lenny Bruce path of heroin abuse and losing your soul. Yeah, okay. Dear Len, send us a package.
If somebody said to me, hey, come here.
But you didn't go down the using alcohol to fire you and all that stuff during those years.
I walked through, and when I look back, I walked through drugs and drinking and everything. I walked through, you know, waiting at 3 o'clock in the morning on deserted platforms to go home. Through it and still do it that way.
All right, okay.
Driven like a lunatic.
So when Carson gave you that smile, did that appease it? Or did it just say...
Change my life.
Okay.
Carson was that strong in those days.
He was, wasn't he?
Said,
yeah.
You're a star. That was it. The doors opened.
Did all the doors fly open in every direction?
Every
then?
Direction. But then the real work began because... and I watched this with fascination. You can go on a show and be funny once. It's not the first time and it's not the second time. It's the third time you go on that you're funny. And it's the 10th time you go on that you're funny to establish yourself.
Yeah.
And so when I got the cluster, I was smart enough somewhere in my brain, thank God, that I knew this is the time to really go to work.
Okay.
So I went, I began to work every single night in Greenwich Village to prepare for the next Carson shot.
All right, okay, right.
And so I would do that every 6 weeks. I would spend those 6 weeks every night working on new material. So every time I went back, I was stronger.
You were fresh.
I was fresh. Never repeated, never. And that's a lot of work.
And would you go back on as guest or as guest presenter?
Guest for a long time.
And then guest presenter
and
in
then
a
guest
later
presenter.
Stage.
And the first woman guest presenter, and then the first guest host whenever he went away, and that went on for 8 years.
That must have been a wonderful time, though. You must have felt, good God, look at...
No, because nothing's ever been...
All right.
I've never stopped to look. When I was guest presenter, they wouldn't give you any guests, so you had to go out and get your own guests. So
calling old friends from the village.
You were calling and you were begging. And then you'd say to them, how about, and they'd say, no.
Okay.
I brought Elton John on, took a big fight the first time. I brought Cher on, took a big fight. I brought Lily on, Lily Tomlin, took a big fight. And then when they do well, they turn him over to Johnny. You couldn't get him anyhow.
Okay, here, I wish I could play, but I can't because I don't have a clip of Joan performing in Greenwich Village during what at least to me seemed like glory days. Think about it. Getting an inspiring note from Lenny Bruce, gigging in the same late night coffee bars as Bob Dylan, let's skip the idea of chatting with Woody Allen, and having a lesbian love affair with Streisand on stage. I love the way in the next clip, Joan Rivers, a romantic realist or realistic romantic, corrects me when I say she was deeply in love. She tells me it was deeply in like with one particular husband. The first lucky man was James Sanger, whom Joan married in 1955, a marriage that was annulled later that same year. And the second was Edgar Rosenberg, whom Rivers married in 1965. Tellingly, she skims over the name of one and doesn't mention the other by name.
You also married around that time, didn't you?
I married my husband, yes, right away.
Very soon after things fell into place, career-wise, your heart fell back into place.
Yeah.
And also, I assume you were deeply in love from the start.
Deeply in like.
Deeply in like, okay.
Yeah,
right.
He was terrific. He was.
All right.
It was a very good marriage.
And when did it grow from deeply in like to one
presumes,
I hope?
Well, it was 21 years.
Okay, so on the 20th year, it hit love, did it?
He was perfect. He was a terrific husband. We had a great time together. It was a great time.
And was he a producer in TV?
He was a
Is
producer.
That how you met him?
Yeah.
Was it like backstage at
he
some TV
He was Johnny
TV
Carson's
show?
Friend.
Oh, was he? All
and
right.
He said to Johnny, I have a script that he was very good friends with Peter Sellers.
Right.
And he said, Peter and I have a script. Who do you know can punch it up? And Johnny said,
write it.
Rewrite it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Punch
all
it
right.
up.
Yeah, yeah,
American
yeah,
fashion.
Yeah.
Who can make it funny and make it brighter. It needs a rewrite. And Carson said, well, this girl, I came on as a writer the first time. There's this really funny comedian that was just on the show, comedian writer. Maybe she would do it. And he called me, and that's how we met.
Okay, how quickly did he ask you out? When he saw
he
your
got
writer?
Married 4 days.
What?
4 days.
4 days after you, 4 days after you met?
Yeah.
Good God, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That was because your writing was so impressive, wasn't
it? That's what it was.
That was a whirlwind romance.
Yeah, that was a whirlwind. Poor man. Yes, that was a whirlwind romance.
But it also, over those years before things changed, you had tons of stuff going on in your life. There was loads of career successes, opportunities. You must have felt at this stage, I have a great husband. I now have a daughter, Melissa, and I'm doing all these different, I'm acting, I'm writing. You must have felt, this is it, now I have it all.
Never.
Not even then.
It's a business that you don't have it all.
Okay.
That everything they see that works.
All right.
The 24 failures that don't work.
Okay.
Even now, I mean, especially now, where I'm in such a high at the moment of my career, there are so many things that are falling apart, but then something else comes up.
Okay. So you never, it's not like the kind of 9-to-5 job where there's the security of.
There's no security.
In this business.
No
right.
security.
See, people assume, and people who are struggling in the music business I know in Ireland, or actors, are assuming once I get to a level, it will all be easy flowing.
No, it not only won't be easy flowing, there'll be more pitfalls, plus there are other people below you trying to pull you down.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's a...
Chop at your heels.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the joy is when you're on stage.
Yeah.
The joy is the execution of it.
Yeah.
I know that sounds so corny.
Not just...
But that is truly... To go out 10 days and perform for audiences is so wonderful. To write something is so wonderful. It's all about the execution of something,
yeah.
doing it, being allowed to do something.
But you are the person who knows yourself when it's wonderful. You
yeah.
don't have to wait till someone else says, Joan, this is great.
No. Well, I know it's wonderful just to be able to do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, the execution of it.
Ah!
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So things then turned around, obviously. Had
yeah.
they turned around, my partner saw you on television talking about your husband's death, and Ireland has a huge rate of suicide, particularly young men.
Oh.
For we've the highest rate of young men suicide in Europe, which nobody talks
Why?
About.
Why?
Nobody knows. The west of Ireland, those barren areas, there are young men found dead every week. So it's kind of like, I'm very aware we're talking to a million people, and anything you can say that might help them, I would appreciate, and I'm sure they would appreciate. So
yeah.
what was it because, my reading of it is that you lost a show, and he as producer lost a show, he had a heart attack?
He had a heart attack
right.
that sent him into tremendous depression.
Okay.
And
was this because he was working too hard? Was it to go
and
too frantically?
And God knows what he was eating.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And God knows what the DNA was.
Okay, all
was
right.
17 years
How old was he?
He was 51.
Okay, very young.
Very young.
Okay.
And he had this terrible heart attack, and then they put him on all the wrong medicine. They had a thing on Halcyon, which they've taken off, which depresses you.
Okay.
And then we had started our own show, and he was fighting with Rupert Murdoch.
Rupert Murdoch?
Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, really? Okay.
Who owned Fox Television.
What was the show?
Show was a late night show called That Show with Joan Rivers.
Okay.
And my husband thought he was going to beat, you don't beat Rupert Murdoch, and you just don't. And we were 50-50 partners, but they signed the check. And what I learned is whoever signs the check is your boss. You can
okay.
own 50%, I can own 50%. If I have the money and I have to hand you the check,
right.
I'm still.
But did Murdoch Organization own 50?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And so they were our boss. And he and Murdoch were. Butting heads.
For a long period or for a little short
while? Well, it was 7 months.
It's a long time to be fighting.
And a long time. And they brought me in on a Thursday and they said, you can stay. All the story, the show is failing. All lies. Numbers are fine, but your husband has to go. And I knew how mentally upset he was already.
Oh,
very
yeah,
depressed.
Okay.
And that was a Thursday night and I said, if he goes, I go. Never thinking they'd say,
okay.
And they said, tomorrow's your last show.
Oh, did they? Right.
So.
As an immediate response to.
That was
yeah.
it.
Oh, okay.
I guess they had worked it all out.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Never thinking I would say that.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Okay.
And.
Well, how did you. Did you collapse inside at that
what
moment?
What are you going to do?
Shit.
And Friday was the last show, which was horrible. But my husband was more of a problem. And he knew that it was his fault. And he killed himself 3 weeks later. Direct cause of effect.
All right, but in that 3 weeks, had you tried to say to him, look, these things happen, or it's
no,
not
No, I was
fault.
Very angry. I can't tell you I was a wonderful wife at home.
Okay, all right.
I can't say that, oh, I was being gracious. I was trying, but believe me, I was very angry.
At him?
Oh, because it was his fault.
Oh, okay, all right, okay.
Well, I saw it that way then.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally
yeah.
his fault.
Yeah.
And in any case, everything was collapsing.
Right.
And he went to Philadelphia, and killed himself.
Had you any sense he's going to go that far?
No, no. I thought we were going to separate. I thought that
oh,
was
did you?
Going to happen.
All
and
right.
And I said, if you don't get help, I'm out of here. It was
All
that
right.
simple.
Okay.
It's
All
enough.
Right.
Just
All
you
right.
either start getting help, or you've already ruined my career. You either get help, or I'm leaving. You know,
okay.
things happen, progression. And he committed suicide, which I truly, both from the blue. And what it does to a family, you know, and I work so hard with suicide survivors
I know
now.
You too, yeah.
And the anger's still in me. I'm still angry.
But when you got the call saying he'd done it, was it anger or was it? Did you feel shit? It was my. I've added to this.
Oh, of course, there's
the feeling of guilt.
Guilt, tremendous guilt. I did.
And was it a phone call you got from somebody to say?
No,
he's
my
gone?
Daughter told me. They
oh,
called
did...
me to tell me I wasn't home. Some son of a bitch told her.
Oh,
she
God,
was 16
right.
years old.
She's not a
Philadelphia
kid.
Police called, and they said, your mother home? She said, no. They said, well, please tell your father killed her.
Really? My God. All
it
right.
was.
All right, that's savage. Okay, so she then had to tell her mom. She had to deal with
to
herself and then tell you.
Tell me.
And did she phone you or go to you?
She came to see me.
Okay.
Came over and told me. And it devastates you, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't tell
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
What did we do wrong or what could we have done? And my daughter had spoken to him the night before, and he had done a terrible thing. He had said, I'm coming home tomorrow. And then he hung up the phone and killed himself. And so she had to deal with all those demons of What could I have said? What should I have said? What didn't I say? And still has to deal with it. I mean, it's,
but she didn't feel responsible, did she?
Well, she kept saying, what could I have said on the phone that...
That might have changed
it. Might have changed it.
It's terrible, isn't it, to inflict that on a 16-year-old, too, though?
That's probably why I'm still so angry at what you did to your daughter. Just yeah. say that to her and yeah. hang up and... You know, and we know that suicide, someone has to be desperately unhappy. And
yeah.
that the pain is so great, they don't even think of the people around them. But I worry about the people around.
Yeah.
I'm about survivors.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay to be angry, and it's okay to be furious at that person to the day you die.
Okay.
And besides the grief, and besides the anguish, and besides all the mixed emotions that you have, it's an ever-healing anguish.
But did you love him? Do you love him, or can you rise above?
Did I love him? I loved him all through my marriage.
All right, okay.
Do I love him now? No.
Okay, because
I still haven't settled with that.
Okay.
Somebody said to me, oh, when you die, you'll get to heaven and see Edgar. And I said, I'll kill the fucker. I'll kill him for what he did to us. Fucking kill him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What he did to my daughter.
Yeah. It's people who haven't experienced this don't understand that rage.
That they went to. Fucking kill him. He's not seeing me in heaven.
So did you not also feel angry at the industry and the whole thing?
No, because looking back, it was our naivete. As I said, whoever signs your check is your boss. And you've got to... it taught me how to work very differently because there are rules. And when you accept the show, you're tacitly accepting their rules.
Okay.
So the choice is, do I want to work within this world, or don't do the show?
Okay, all right, okay.
Well, that's how I've managed to survive.
But did your career then fall apart?
Totally.
All right, why? You were blacklisted, but I don't understand.
I was blacklisted because I left Carson, and I was a direct competition to Carson. So NBC put out all kinds of terrible, which they should, you know, if you're going up against them.
They put out stuff about you.
Oh, she's terrible, she's a bitch, she's a this, she's a that. Very bad stuff.
All right.
Then I went on Fox, and then when I was fired from Fox, they weren't going to say Rupert Murdoch and my husband. So they said that the numbers were bad.
Okay.
So that...
Oh, that was what was given out as the story.
The story was, that's why we let her go. And what a shame her husband killed himself. That's not the reason.
As an aside.
Oh, her numbers were terrible. That went. Then Vegas went away because Vegas said nobody wants to see a person's husband just kill themselves.
Did I say that? That's
the
record.
My contract back.
It's cruel country. Cruel business, isn't it?
And my daughter said, you could have saved Daddy. What did you do? Daddy did this. So she stopped talking to me for a year. My husband, the last week of his life, was trying to make things right for us.
Okay.
Because he knew, obviously, he was going to kill himself. So we took all our money.
Yeah.
It's every cliche you want to hear. And invested in terrible things. It all went down the tubes. So that was gone.
So were you broke?
I was broke.
And in debt?
Not in debt, okay. But broke, but with a lot of relatives that were coming for their monthly checks and a lot of relatives that were in college. Good old...
Yeah, okay.
Cousin Joan.
Okay.
And a daughter at 60. It was a mess. I couldn't get a job. Couldn't get a job.
Were you ever suicidal?
Yeah.
Okay.
After that, I was.
At that particular point, I can imagine.
With suicide, the other thing, it's a concept till it comes into the family.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a reality because it's now a choice.
Yeah.
You know, now you say, oh, they committed suicide. Means nothing. Oh, they had tuberculosis. It means nothing. But if somebody in your family actually committed suicide, it's now, oh, I can do this, or I can commit suicide.
Yeah.
Or it's a viable thing. And there was one point that it was my life was so low. And I literally took a gun out. And I was sitting there, here I go. And I had this little dog, this little muddy dog, Spike, who just died, this one. And who actually came and sat in my lap. And I thought, he's the only person that needs him. Nobody will take this terrible dog. Nobody would take care of poor old Spikers.
But see how humor is a saving grace?
Yeah. Who's going to take this disgusting dog?
So you changed your mind.
I changed my mind. Because it's Scottish.
But is that not the Irish love irony? And if that's not irony, for Christ's sake.
It's hideous. Rescue dog.
The dog who saved my life. I mean, you should. That should
but,
be put on spikes.
You're waiting for like a pretty little dog. Horrible dog, no teeth.
So how then did you turn it around? Was it a job opportunity opened up? Or
no,
did you grip life that night and say, if I'm not going to kill myself, I'm going to
I'm going to start again,
yeah.
Which I always do.
Yeah.
I always say, start at the bottom. And I went back and started working in little tiny clubs.
Okay.
And started building.
That must have been difficult, though. I mean, so I know it's a sentence, but it must have been really...
Oh, when you've been playing to 5,000
yeah.
people... And you're now saying thank you to somebody for letting you go in a club in Toronto that holds 80.
Yeah.
And the audience
yeah,
isn't that thrilled to see you either. You
yeah,
know?
Okay.
What the hell's she doing here?
You have to really reach inside yourself, don't you?
You have to really say, I got to do something.
Yeah.
Here.
So, like, it's funny how we tap in our resources we didn't know we had.
And it was also about my daughter, because I didn't want my daughter to just have two parents. That collapsed and gave it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And
right.
It was really about saying to her, this is life, and you buck it. And you move, which is another bit, you move forward. You do not get stuck in where you are, in the morass of where you are. You
right.
move your body forward. It's like coming out of mud. You move
yeah.
your body forward.
That's like the Irish coming out of the bog.
Yeah.
Look what we're doing now. Yeah. Because, you know, best actors, best writers, best
everything.
You know? But
and
part of that is our psychology is coming out of the bog. And
but
coming out of the
mud. It's about time. You have the Abbey Players for how long?
Absolutely.
Sure, no, Casey
yeah.
gave you the stuff.
He did,
years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, yeah. But no, that did give us, it gives a raised confidence.
Yeah.
You know, to see, hey, we're doing the world stage.
Yeah.
And that's all part of what it is.
Yeah.
So how long did that kind of upward spiral take then?
Oh, a good 10 years to really get back.
All right.
To where, and then again, everything crashed around me, but much less. And then I pulled myself up.
What was the second crash?
Second crash was the ageism factor started to come in.
Oh, right.
I lost my daytime talk show because they wanted somebody younger.
Okay.
My business, my jewelry business, which is on QVC, seen in Ireland.
Yeah.
I decided to take it public, and the guy that took it public from me absconded with $37 million.
Oh, right. Okay.
And the rights to my name and likeness in any capacity.
He took the...
Well, I had signed everything.
Oh, really?
You're going to make me rich. Okay. Sign here.
Okay.
And so I had to get my name back and my likeness back and pay off a debt, which I'm still paying off, $37 million, which is hilarious.
Absolutely.
But it's being paid off and start kind of again. And then the uphill fight now with this whole age thing, which is
yeah.
right there in your face in our business.
Yeah.
And to me, I just finally got my own television show again, which is on Channel
Recently?
5 here.
All right, okay.
So it'll be in Ireland.
Okay, so to fight ageism, and I wasn't even going to mention it, but you do have to work your body and your face.
You have to.
You know, because you're out competing with...
Everybody, and every actress does it. When
yeah.
you look at a Michelle Pfeiffer, who is so
yeah.
beautiful, and she's being given mother roles now.
It's
the business.
It is. It's youth obsessed.
Is youth
obsessed. So, I mean, it's almost like it's the opposite of Eastern society, where as you get older, you're regarded as the wise person,
yeah.
but you're thrown on the scrap heap.
Yeah.
I think that's part of why you mentioned that. I think it's part of what happened to Elvis. When he started getting fat, he started saying, I'm not the sex symbol I used to be. I might as well just go and die. He
yeah.
wasn't, you know?
And if you're only relying on sex.
All right.
As you know, I look around, I think, thank God I wasn't, you know, God is very good. If I had been the Pamela Andersons and this, you're over.
Yeah.
Then you become a parody of yourself.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is so awful to see these older women hanging on.
All right.
It's all.
So you would say to anyone who's working within the media, if you have to get nip
of
and tuck,
course.
If you have to go over the whole thing, get it done. If it
and
helps you keep
woman,
your job.
And not only get you, it makes you feel, it's not about what others look at. It makes you feel better.
Okay.
And
yeah,
that's
yeah,
to
yeah.
a man or to a woman.
Yeah.
If you hate your nose, then. Work 3 jobs and fix your nose.
Okay, yeah.
Makes you happy.
So is it work, but are you still encountering that? Are you still having people say, Joan, you're too old for this,
all
we can't
time.
Give you this gig? Okay.
All the time.
But you get something as big as the Oscars. It's great to see that. You and you,
yeah.
Melissa.
It's great.
It's wonderful. It's great for us to see it over there, you know?
And it's great to, it's, but you have to also understand that you're not going to get certain things
okay.
anymore. So you get other things.
Okay.
And
all right.
it's a do-it-yourself business. I'm going back to Broadway for the 4th time. And I suddenly realized, I wrote three of those plays.
Yeah, yeah.
The fourth was Neil Simon, God love him. The one, there was one to Neil Simon, this. But you just gotta do it yourself. It's always do it yourself, try it yourself. Don't expect anybody to hand you anything.
But what is, what? I mean, there's a good argument that you should just relax now, isn't there? And I'm sure you hear it all the time.
And do what?
Okay,
I love what I'm doing.
Okay, all right.
What would I do? People say, what would I do? I would go into community theater. You know, so I might as well do it in Broadway. What would I do? I'd be funny if my girl was at a luncheon. I'd rather be funny in Dublin on the stage. I mean,
Do you have a love life?
Yeah.
Do you have a lover? Do you have a partner? You didn't marry again.
I didn't marry again.
Okay.
I had, since my husband, I had two major
relationships. All right. Okay. So that's what you could do, Joan.
But these men are getting older.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And I don't know where I am now. Limbo.
In terms of balancing the relationships against the career?
And in terms of everything. I don't fit in with old people. I don't fit in with young people.
All
but
right.
I think that's good for comedy. I don't fit in with anybody, so that's good.
Well, that's a burning fire.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's another thing. Because the worst thing is to see any artist becoming complacent.
Well, then you
and
did.
A parody and repeating themselves.
And when they grand old, when they become beloved, you're screwed.
All right, okay.
You know what I mean?
All right.
Oh, here's so and so. We've loved him for years as a grand. No. Get out there and knock a home run out of the ballpark. That's
so
what
you should do. I can feel from you the same drive I imagine you had when you went, the first marriage broke up and you went out there and said, okay,
yeah.
This is do or die.
Yeah. And it's still the same.
All right.
I just did this show for Channel 5, this series, and the producer, and he said it as a compliment, the head of the channel, who I love, said to me, you gave us notes like a producer. I've never seen a performer so involved.
All right, okay.
But of course I'm involved. It's my show.
All right.
So.
And how is, I know that your daughter is the center of your life, and I know
yeah.
you wrote a book to her on the eve of her marriage.
Yeah, it's gone.
Is it gone? Okay. Oh, which is gone, the marriage?
The marriage
oh,
is gone.
Oh, is it? Okay, the book didn't work then, didn't it?
The book is a great book.
Okay, all right.
Now I'm going to write to her thoughts and comments on the eve of your divorce.
Okay. But you and she, I am obviously, all echoes of shadows and tensions are all gone, I imagine.
Oh, no, I don't think that'll ever go. There's always an undercurrent somewhere, as there's any girl and daughter, any mother
right.
and daughter, and also about her father. There's still unresolved problems there.
So she's never said to you, Mom, I absolutely now understand, I accept, and I forgive you.
Oh, she does.
Oh, does she say that?
Oh, yeah.
Because that's important. It's important for you to hear that.
Yeah, and she said that there was some, they did a thing on 2020, which is a big show.
Yeah, I know.
In the United States. And she said, now that I'm older, I understand. She was furious. I tried to go back to work as soon as my husband killed himself. Because the only place I couldn't think was on stage. But I couldn't get jobs, but I tried to get jobs.
Right.
She was very angry at that. And but now she came out and she said now she understands why. So she's come to grips with it much better.
All right, okay. But she wouldn't be too happy to hear you say you'd kill your husband again if you meet him up in heaven. Would she?
I said it to her.
Have you? So she understands.
She knows
where you're coming from.
And again, she's now 32 years old.
All
and
right.
She now understands the obligations we have, that he just up and did it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, come back here and help me.
Yeah. So half her life was lived before and half has been lived since that.
Yeah.
She's 32 years old. So is she, if you look back, is she the thing that you regard as your greatest achievement, or is it what you have done with yourself?
I have two children.
Oh, have you two children?
No, my career.
Oh, okay, sorry.
And Melissa.
Okay.
And they're both my greatest achievements.
All right, there's no A or B.
I'm very proud of Melissa. I think she's gone through a bad divorce, and the people are not nice on the other side.
Okay.
And she's doing it with such style and strength and composure that I would take a gun and blow all their heads off.
Okay, yeah.
And so I'm very proud. I'm very proud of her. Very proud of her.
Right.
I also look at my career and go, I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of that one, too.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm very proud of both my children.
Okay, John, it was the light talk to you.
I'm so glad.
Actually, the tape ran out there, though Joan Rivers and I did chat for about a half hour more. In fact, when she heard I was writing a biography of Richard Harris, Joan offered to get for me videotapes of a show a friend of hers in LA had made. And weeks later, one day when I was walking past Dublin Shelbourne Hotel, I heard a shout from behind me, "Joe Jackson, I didn't forget about those Richard Harris tapes. I'm still working on that." And that night, myself and my girlfriend at the time were Joan's guests at and after the show. Frank Delaney's wife, Diane Mayer, was right. Joan Rivers, in private, was a lovely lady. She died, as I said, in 2014. I dedicate this show to her memory. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Joe Jackson here again. I thank you for listening to this edition of the Joe Jackson Interviews podcast. More can be heard on my website, joejacksoninterviewer.com.